Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Market Volatility Conference Call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mike Evans, Regional Vice President, Retail Sales. Please go ahead, Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Eric. Appreciate that. And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to week four of self-isolation when the previously unimaginable begins to feel normal, I think. We know that it's an extremely challenging time for all Canadians and want to extend our appreciation for you for taking the time to join us on today's call. You know, there's never been a more important time to stay connected to one another, and we heard firsthand from you the value you place on timely information from your partners. And we recognize that you have many clients concerned about recent market developments and volatility and the long-term effects those have on their investments and their futures. Each week, we remain committed to bringing you relevant commentary on these calls from both a macroeconomic and a portfolio management perspective, highlighting recent developments and investment opportunities. Today, we are joined by two senior members of Mackenzie's management team, and with us are Dustin Reed. Dustin is the Vice President, Investment Management, and Mackenzie's Chief Fixed Income Strategist. In his role, Dustin helps determine macro positioning by providing views on central banks, monetary and fiscal policy, economic data, inflation, sovereign debt dynamics, and geopolitics. He's going to provide us with a macroeconomic perspective on the evolving crisis and the global fiscal and monetary response to it. Also joining us on today's call is David Arpin. David is the Senior Vice President, Investment Management, and co-team lead on Mackenzie's Blue Water team, a team that has enjoyed considerable success, winning 11 Lipper Awards in the past 5 years for both the Canadian Growth and Canadian Growth Balanced funds. Both are five-star rated and have won A-plus awards in the last 2 years. Dina and David run the Global Growth and Global Growth Balanced funds as well as the U.S. Growth Fund, all top decile versus peers since Bluewater assumed management. David will share his thoughts on the global economic backdrop and discuss how Bluewater's conservative growth investment style can be applied in these markets. Now, today's call is being recorded, and there will be a playback made available to everyone on the call. Your sales team will follow up with that. Gentlemen, welcome. Lots to cover today. I think we'll kick this off with the macro side of things with you, Dustin. So let's start. What do we know? We've just completed some of the most volatile weeks in market history, but things appear to be settling down somewhat. The VIX came down this week, as did high yield spreads. The unemployment numbers ballooned to more than 10 million in the last 2 weeks in the U.S., yet markets have posted some strong rebounds this week, perhaps forecasting light at the end of the tunnel. What's your read on where we are now, and what's the pathway to normal look like?
Sure. Well, thanks very much, Mike. And thank you, everyone, for joining the call this afternoon and taking time out of obviously very busy schedules. So I'll speak on behalf of the fixed income team, and in particular focus my comments, as Mike said, on the macro side. It's been a wild 4 or 5 weeks, in my opinion, much more wild than 2007, 2008 through the global financial crisis, the GFC. This is really unprecedented stuff. And we're all feeling it from a, from an economic perspective, from a lifestyle perspective, and, from a family perspective, from an investment perspective. It's a challenge, and we're all challenged. And, our team in particular, all of Mackenzie, but speaking in particular for fixed income, we're meeting, twice a day, at least on the phone, spending 2 hours as a senior leadership team and really, parsing through all the issues, and trying to really understand where flows are, where liquidity is, where markets are, where markets are going, where consensus is. I'm trying to give my 2 cents into that. And obviously the portfolio managers are all doing the same. So, it's a full court press, so to speak, and it has been for weeks and will continue to be for weeks, if not months, if not more. It's a very interesting, point in time in terms of this mini cycle where you've got risk that's been bid off the bottom, and you've seen equities come up, roughly 20%, maybe more, off the lows, surprising a number of people, probably. I would say myself included. I thought we'd get a risk rally, but I didn't think it'd be this ferocious and hang in there this long. The reason is because I think there's a lot of bad news to come, not necessarily on the medical side, but more on the economic side, and Mike alluded to that. We haven't even really touched the tip of the iceberg here in terms of what we're going to see in the weeks, months, and I would even say maybe quarter or quarters ahead. We're going to get the Canadian payroll data tomorrow for March, not the usual Friday because it's Good Friday holiday. And, I've seen everything from, I've seen a couple of estimates as high as a million or a million one. I think RBC and Citi are at a million or a million one each, with consensus at half a million for the March print. There's talk of non-farm payrolls for April that will get printed in May that could be 10 million or more, maybe even 15 million, given the pace of unemployment claims that we've seen over the past couple of weeks, and that's probably not going to abate anytime soon. So, in my former life, when I was a pure economist, I don't want to necessarily completely ditch that, and the fundamentalist in me says, wow, we've got unbelievable numbers coming ahead of us, and yeah, the market is working, to price that in, and in many ways has priced that in, but I still feel like in a way it's, when we see those numbers come across, it's going to be challenging. Where I'm also really focused is kind of the transmission mechanism. There's been at least, I would say as of 2 or 3 days ago, there were at least 300 policy measures done, across the globe from a monetary and fiscal perspective. So central banks and governments. 300 policy measures. I mean, it's the amount of information flow coming across is unbelievable. It's unheard of. But the credit transmission mechanism is important here. And just because you're throwing a ton of money at the issue, and clearly that's happening, it's about the take up, right? So you see these headlines here domestically about some of these firms that are having a tough time applying for the wage supplement. You see things in the U.S. where the Small Business Association, the Small Business Act isn't necessarily getting all the money out in time. Some of the people that are unemployed or have tried to get unemployment, A, can't even get on the system because it's completely overrun, the state system. And B, if you don't have a bank account and you're kind of on the lower income side, and you're waiting for a check, it could be up to 20 weeks before you get a check. So you look at that and you say, how quickly are people and businesses going to rebound here within a reasonable stretch, right? So what we want to pay attention to, I think, are the consumer confidence numbers, globally for sure, but in particular Canada and the U.S. for the purposes of this call. And I think that, we need to see those numbers, obviously they've come down a huge amount. They need to stabilize and move higher. And I think that will be a real key driver or key indicator, so to speak, as to how, things might move forward. There's a lot of talk 2 or 3 weeks ago about the V-shaped recovery, quick bounce back, and then there's a lot of talk of the U, and you get to look at a lot of different fonts and, how straight line is the bottom of the U, or how much of a curve is the bottom of the U. I kind of never really believed in that. And I saw somebody who's been in the business a long time, Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics. He said, I'm looking at it as a Nike swoosh kind of, economic recovery. And that really, nobody knows, but that picture, if you can picture it, really resonated with me, the Nike swoosh. I think it's going to take a while because you're going to see the unemployment rate pop higher, call it 10, 15, 20%, maybe more. It's going to go up very, very quickly, and it's going to take a long time for it to come lower. And that makes me, concerned for business, for consumption, for, fixed business investment, for housing. Traditional economics suggests that you know, these things take a while to come out of. And I'm not even getting into the science or the medical, which is well beyond my abilities in terms of, you know, social distancing, or are you going to go to a concert? Are you going to go to a restaurant? Are you going to get on an airplane? What's the reaction function? Even if you're, you know, even if, you know, some areas of the economy are, you know, quote unquote, allowed to go back to work. I think that there's a lot of optimism that's been baked into, call it, risk assets from this perspective over the last few days. So, you know, I could very easily be proven wrong, and in many ways I hope I am, because obviously I don't want to see the economy move into a very serious recession or worse. But I just feel that the market's kind of put the cart a little bit before the horse here. So in that regard, from a fixed income perspective, we still like being long duration. We still see yields lower. We still like the 10 to 30 year part of the curve in size, with whether that's the Canadian curve or the U.S. curve. We continue to like the idea that the Fed is going to be in size. The Fed's balance sheet has moved from around probably about $4.5 trillion from December 2018, from about $4.4 trillion, I think, from December 2018, the famous autopilot comment, to now being around $5.8 trillion. And, you know, there are some estimates out there that the Fed will be at $10 trillion. 9 or 10 trillion by the time this is all said and done, when it's finished hoovering up all of these treasuries, TIPS, nominal treasuries, TIPS, mortgage-backed securities, etc. And that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of liquidity. But again, it's all about the credit transmission mechanism. So you can throw as much money, you know, the analogy I use is, you know, you can ask any price you want for a good or service, but usually good, you know, on eBay, on the internet. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's where it's going to trade. And I think that, you know, that's very analogous to, you know, what's probably going to happen here. You're going to throw a lot of money at the problem, a lot of money, but, you know, is the credit transmission mechanism there? Are people able to, you know, figure out the program, get the money in time, able to defer payments, whether it's your mortgage or your rent, or, you know, lines of credit, credit card, anything, car payment, multiple things, obviously, you know, can you defer those things? So I'm cautious here. And, you know, I think that there's a while to go. And I think that, a couple things that'll be interesting kind of, just kind of going forward. Now I'll leave it kind of at those thoughts. One, again, the Fed's obviously done a ton of things. One thing they have not done is they have not decided to do a program focusing on high yield paper at this point. They are looking at some investment grades, investment grade paper, and obviously they're doing a lot on the treasury side and mortgage backed security side. But there's a bit of a difference between the IG and the high yield side, and so there's a lot of questioning and prodding around the idea of, will the Fed do something on the high yield side, particularly, you know, the highest rated high yield, so to speak. And, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out if the Fed's going to do that. On the Canadian side, one question that remains to be answered, I guess it's partially answered, but Bank of Canada's buying basically very, very short end provincial paper, I believe inside a year. And so there's a question, given the amount of issuance that the provinces are going to have to do and will do, is there going to be enough of a market to mop up all that paper? And if not, then will the Bank of Canada come in, or will there be a federal program that kind of, you know, parallels the Bank of Canada to buy provincial paper? So we're spending a lot of time on that and where the value might be, from that perspective, which I think are very interesting. And the last comment I'll make, this is a bit more longer term, I call it medium term structural, is I'm personally spending a lot of time on, trying not to spend all my days on just watching headlines, because you get lost in the headlines to a point. I'm trying to think of, you know, what are the interesting trades for the firm, and in particular fixed income, when we're done here. And this will pass at some point, I do believe. But one thing I think will be a resounding scar is that I think there's a risk to the European monetary union. And, you know, I've been through a few crises in my career. I've usually pushed back. In fact, I've always pushed back on the idea of, a euro breakup. I will go out there and say the crazy thing that I think this time is different. I think that the way that the ECB, the European Central Bank, is going about doing things and the way Brussels is frankly not going about doing things means that the Italians are going to be very, very upset with the way they're getting treated by the European Council in Brussels. And there is going to be a real pushback later this year or next year that suggests that the electorate in Italy will think that Brussels forgot about them. And there is a real risk that Italy will leave the monetary union. And I think that there's some really interesting opportunities emerging in the Italian sovereign space, the debt space, maybe to a slight lesser extent, euro, the currency, but definitely in the Italian paper space, also maybe in some of the other peripherals, particularly Spain. But we'll have to see how this pandemic plays out for the next couple of months. So we have some positioning on in that Italian trade that I just spoke about, although we would look to tweak it depending on how things go from here. So those are just a couple of thoughts kind of on a macro and a fixed income and a trading space, kind of where we're at. But obviously, Mike, I'm happy to take some questions. But let me leave it there so I don't drone on forever.
Great, Dustin. Thanks. I think you did a great job of sort of summarizing what's on a lot of folks' minds and where we are currently. Why don't we turn it over to David, get the Blue Water perspectives, and then we'll circle back and ask some questions. So, David, welcome. Thank you for being here. Would love to get your insights from a Blue Water perspective, how you and Dina are feeling, how you've positioned the portfolios, and what's happening from your perspective right now.
Great. So thanks very much, Mike. Thanks to everyone for dialing in and listening to this today. I know there's a lot of calls coming your way, so I really appreciate your spending the time with us here. You know, Dustin gave a nice little overview here that you're about to see the biggest drop-off in economic activity in post-war history, and it's going to have a big earnings effect on businesses in general. You're going to see headlines over the next few weeks, even probably over the next month. It's going to just be a list of we've never seen this before in history. It's worse than the Great Depression. Just keep in mind as you see those, as your clients see those, this is intentional. This is not economic activity just disappearing because the economy's collapsed. It's an intentional move to shut things down, slow the transmission, and we do have the capacity to bring things back up afterwards. I'm going to talk about that a little bit because most of our focus internally a month ago, it was a focus on the virus itself, on transmission, on how fast things were going to move. Now it's really a focus on the recovery side of things. I really like that Nike swoosh. So I'll come back to that a little bit as well. But from a portfolio management standpoint, from an equity standpoint, the number one thing you always think about is this going to affect every company the exact same way? During a big downturn, during a recession, it's usually hard to find massive winners. That's why the market goes down. But there really is a big range of impact in terms of individual industry and individual companies. So I'll come back and touch on that. But most of what we've been doing has really been dealing with that over the last month and change. The final thing to think through is, you know, we haven't had a destruction of productive capacity. This hasn't been a massive natural disaster. There hasn't been a war. So when we come through the other end of this, we should be able to get back to something approaching normal. The challenge and the question is, when is the other end of this? So Dustin mentioned the idea of a V-shaped recovery. From a pandemic standpoint, from a virus standpoint, we were initially wondering how long it would take countries to begin to bend the curve. I think that's really underway now. If you look in Europe in particular, you see it in country after country. You're starting to see, Italy was the first major developed disaster country, and that's really getting steadily better here over time. After you do a full lockdown, about 10 days later, the curve starts to flatten. Another 7 to 10 days after that, it really starts to fall. And you're beginning to hear countries in Europe talking about reopening. You're seeing it in Italy now. That was this morning. Austria is a little bit further ahead than they are. They got a bit of a handle on this earlier. So we're now beginning to look at what is going to come next. I think the most important thing to think about there is I see a lot of comparisons to what happened in China. In China, we managed to get the case level to roughly zero. The cases you're seeing are coming from external. They're not internal to the country. No epidemiologists I've talked to think that that is a likely scenario for the developed markets, that we're going to have no cases. We're simply going to get cases to a low level, something like what South Korea had done, and then we're going to have to manage them. And that will have a huge impact on what reopening actually means. When people talk about reopening, you kind of think, oh, we're going right back to normal in 6 weeks or 4 weeks. We really do not think that that's the case, and we think that's enormously important when you're looking at individual equities or individual industries. When you go back in history and you look at past pandemics, what used to happen historically has been a very much a V-shaped recovery. So when you think about something like SARS in 2003, it was completely contained. It was taken out of the economy. It was gone, and as a result, we bounced right back. If you go back further to 1918 and 1957 and 1968, we didn't stop those. They swept right through. 3 months later, you were at the peak. 3 months after that, either you'd had it or you hadn't. And at that point, it had burned itself out through the population. In this case, we're fighting it. We're not going to eliminate it, which means we're going to have this perpetual risk of further breakouts. Another important thing to think through is there's a chunk of the economy, a chunk of GDP. It's not going to come back anytime soon. I'll talk about that in more detail, but it's areas like travel, it's areas like tourism, it's areas like large group gathering. That is just not going to come back as we reopen. So what is the shape of a reopen? Well, you know, as I said, you say reopen and it sounds like we're going back to normal. What we've seen is if you do a full lockdown, every country that's done it has seen a caseload flattening and then a fall if they've done it long enough. Every country that has done nothing, the early stages for all of us when we had no social distancing, we saw this very rapid, large ramp up and spike in the number of cases. So if you think about those two bookends, the full lockdown, cutting transmission, completely open, ramping transmission, it means that if we go back to where we were, if you fully reopen and go back to normal, you're just going to get another huge case spike and you're going to have to shut everything down again. Recent example of that was Japan. Japan had it early. They contained it incredibly well. Then they tried to reopen. Kids went back to school. Everyone went back to the restaurants. People went back to the malls. And a couple days ago, they had to declare a state of emergency, and they're looking at locking down Tokyo. So you simply cannot do that. You cannot fully get back to normal. So there's going to be a middle ground. What should happen is you're going to get your cases low enough over time that you think you can now start to add back activities. We were talking about this internally maybe 2-3 weeks ago, that essentially what you're looking at for every single thing that we all do is how much does it add to transmission is there? So things that have a very high economic and social value but not much transmission, we'll add them back early. Things that are much later on are the things that do not have a whole heck of a lot of economic or social value, but they add a lot to transmission. So, you know, going to hockey games, going to concerts, things like that are not going to come back anytime soon. Travel is going to be impaired and tourism is going to be impaired for a long period of time. What we expect to see is experiments. So you're going to see countries begin to open. They're going to add, Austria's talking about this, we'll add some activities for the first 2 weeks, and we're going to keep testing and see if we have a spike in cases. If we don't, we'll add more activities. Sooner or later, if you add enough, you're going to get caseloads starting to rise, and then you're going to have to slow it down again. So the real way to think about this is we're going to get better, but we're not going back to normal anytime soon, probably until we either have a vaccine or until we have some sort of better medication. And I'll talk about both of those a little bit, particularly the medication side. One of the big things we've seen out there is on the testing side. Large improvements in testing. The U.S. really blew this going back probably 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks ago now. The private market is now involved with this. You've got medical device companies getting into this business. The speed of tests has gone from a day to 5 minutes. So large improvements there. The more testing you have, South Korea has proven this, the more economic activity you can do. So as we get more testing, as we get more experience, this will also get better just because we're going to get quicker at finding people who have it and quicker at quarantining them. You will probably have, or you have seen or will see the suggestion that something like half the population may have already had the virus. If that is the case, then we probably should be reopening today. What we're waiting for there is something called serum testing. It's the ability to test blood to see whether or not you have antibodies for the virus, which tells if you have ever had it. We're waiting for the data there, but we're starting to see some sort of natural experiments, one in Iceland, another in Lombardy region of Italy, suggesting that that story, as wonderful as it sounds, is probably not true. It is probably the case that we have picked up most of the people who have this in countries that have really gone after the testing, which means there is a fairly high mortality rate, which means this is fairly dangerous, and it means that we are not going to be able to reopen quickly. On the compound side, the drug side, we've been watching this for a month now. There's over 300 compounds being tested. Those are now in proper double-blind studies. You always get these stories about how we gave this to three people and they got miraculously better. Good news, people naturally get miraculously better, so that doesn't really tell you very much. As we're watching the studies, there's a few that look pretty promising. We're waiting for data to come out. This will be a game changer if we find something that works early on, where when people start to show symptoms, you give it to them, and it kind of takes the tail of danger off. If it's a drug which only works very much later in the process where someone is extremely ill, it's a huge improvement, but it'll have less of an effect. So we are watching that. We have this long list of all these different drug compounds and you know, how they work, what we expect them to do. Yeah, keep in mind that these are all compounds, by and large, that are already approved for use in humans, which means we can roll them out extremely quickly. We don't have to go through some sort of long approval process. On the vaccine side, vaccines are the silver bullet. The best case here is probably 12 months plus. The issue with vaccines is we're going to have to create a brand new one. There's a lot of promising compounds, but if you are going to give something to 100 million or a billion people, it cannot have even very, very rare side effects. You know, if you have a 1 in 1,000 or a 1 in 10,000 risk, that doesn't sound so bad until you multiply it by 8 billion people. So a vaccine is how you solve this completely, but it is not coming anytime soon. So sort of our big picture on the economic side is, you know, we're watching country by country, we're watching reopenings, we're seeing how that's going. We're going to get a lot more data, a lot more information there over the next 2 months in terms of what activities genuinely can be added back and which ones are going to take a lot longer. We have some guesses at this point. We're suspicious that a number of areas are not coming back anytime soon. The need for social distancing will be with us for a while, and if the industry requires a lot of people sitting or standing close to each other, it's got a big problem. As I mentioned at the beginning, it doesn't affect everybody equally. It doesn't affect all companies equally. So we're really steering to areas where we don't think there's going to be a lot of impact here. The good news is that the uncertainty is gradually dropping. We're learning more. We know more. And that should help calm the markets down a bit over time as well. So in terms of what we're actually doing, what we've actually done, look, I mentioned this is going to have a big effect. You have to adapt. I can't tell you specific buys and sells. We get major compliance trouble if I do that. But what I can do is talk to where we've been looking and where we're not looking. We've had a lot of experience with downturns in the past. This is my third major downturn. Dean has been in the business for about 35 years. So, you know, we have a recession playbook. It's been built on the lessons of past recessions. The first thing I'd say here is you can't just apply it blindly. Just because something had a major effect in the last or a major impact in the last recession, it doesn't mean it will this time. And just because something was extremely defensive in the last recession, some of the most defensive names in the last downturn are not going to be defensive in this one. The biggest thing you think about from a portfolio manager standpoint when it comes to a downturn, when it comes to a recession, is what's the eye of the storm? 2001, 2002, it was information technology and telecom. That was where the downturn was concentrated. 08, 09, it was housing, it was the financial system. This time, it's tourism, it's travel, and it's large gatherings. That's the biggest, most obvious, most glaring problem area. If you're an airline or you're a cruise ship, hotels, casino, movie theater, online travel agency, those areas, they're going to see this huge drop in sales. They're going to have a wipeout of earnings and free cash flows. You know, we're seeing companies that are starting to hint at 60, 70, 80, even 90% declines in revenues. you have a 90% decline in revenues, you are not adjusting your cost structure to deal with that. You will bleed. So if a business is not strong financially going in, it is going bankrupt or it is going to need a bailout. Back in February, when we first really started going at this, what did we do? We simply broke apart the portfolios into three categories, red, yellow, and green. Red companies, red industries were in the eye of the storm. We knew we had to deal with them as fast as possible. Green companies, I'm not saying that there's not going to be any impact, but, you know, having your sales drop by 3% or 5% versus normal is pretty good when you got businesses that are going down by 50. So greens, there's not going to be that material an impact. At this point, we have now completely dealt with the red category. We have no exposure there. We think it's way too early to buy back in. That pushed up our cash levels. Cash was under 5% across all the funds going into this. We peaked at around 12%. We're now back to single digits. It's a little higher in the Canadian fund, about 8-9. It's a little lower in the global fund. It's around 5. We only really wanted to buy green companies at the front end of this. Some of them had some major stock price hits, even though we don't think the businesses will be affected that much. Those are opportunities. From a cash standpoint, cash is a residual for us. You do not force the money back into the market. You do what you have to do first on the defensive side. Then you start trying to take advantage of market volatility, and you don't chase. So we've watched, Dustin highlighted it, a big run back up in the market. That is very common in the middle of these. You got to be careful not to chase as results start getting worse, as the economy starts getting worse. We'll see how the market digests it. So back in February, you know, the path forward was extremely unclear. Now it's getting a lot clearer, and that's helping us with what we are buying. There's some parts of our investment philosophy that always help us out in a downturn. We do not take on balance sheet risk. We do not take on financial risk. We look for businesses that are extremely strong free cash flow generators. We know how they've done in past downturns. I mentioned you have to adapt. You have to be aware that the eye of the storm is moving. But there are some areas out there that are just consistent, steady, stable growth, and they will be right through this. Another big part of the philosophy for us, and we've talked about this on due diligence over the years, we have to avoid tail risk. What does that mean? It means investing in a company where the outcome could be very, very good, or it could be very, very bad. If something goes your way, you could be up 200, 300, 400%. If it doesn't, it's just as likely you're going to lose all your capital. And that is not what we're interested in. I'll give you an example. People will be bottom fishing in the airlines. Airlines are going to see 80 or 90% revenue drops. I mentioned a lot of them don't have great balance sheets as they headed into this. They will need bailouts or they will go broke. Now, if we have a cure that shows up tomorrow, if we have a huge improvement on the treatment side, those stocks are going to rip higher. Every company reopens, travel is back. If you invest in them, you will make a huge amount of money. If that doesn't happen, they're going to need government help. Some of them may get nationalized. If that happens, you may lose all of your investment. Your equity may get wiped out. So you're going to see people investing in those. That is not how we act. That is not how we think. We avoid tail risk. We're looking for companies where, you know, you're going to go right through this without missing a beat, the best we can find. Businesses with a lot of recurring revenues. We have a bunch of subscription businesses where the companies are prepaid for 12 months, so they're really just recognizing revenue, cash that they've already received, and they'll recognize it over the year. So there will not be a big effect on their business. From an economic standpoint, I mentioned we're not going back to where we were. We're going to see companies with more leverage than we used to have. You've already watched companies pulling down lines of credit. You got consumers that are also going to end up more leveraged. We're staying away from commodity businesses. We're staying away from the economically sensitive areas at this point. Finally on that, if a business had major structural problems 3 months ago, they've still got them. It hasn't gotten better. So you're seeing areas like mall-based retail. The stocks have been pushed down a lot. The energy oil area, Dina and I have been talking about now for 4 years, that we've had a major concern around electrification, that there's a major structural question. Did not expect what the Saudis and the Russians decided to do right in the middle of this mess. That really did not help anyone. But that is, again, not an area that we're particularly interested in because we're concerned about a longer-term structural problem there. A lot of turnovers in the funds. On the Canadian fund, we added three new names on the foreign side. On the Canadian side, you know, we went through everything. We think what we own is better than what we don't own still. So we built up some new positions. We reduced some positions, but less actual name turnover there. Global fund, we had five significant eliminations. That's a lot for us. And then there were also a few little positions that we were in the process of eliminating that we went to a bit of a hurry-up offense on. And then on the other side of it, we added five new names as well. Three of them actually were companies that we'd owned in the past and we'd had to sell due to valuation. And as valuations came tumbling down, they went right through where we wanted to buy them. So we did. I mentioned earlier, and Dustin mentioned as well, look, in terms of the equity markets, you generally get a bounce back in the middle of a downturn. It's pretty common to get another sell-off after it. We're seeing earnings estimates for the S&P 500. They're down maybe 15% year over year, and then they're expected to come right back in the third quarter. The nicest thing I can say, that is almost laughably wrong. Those are going to come down sharply as companies begin to report over the next few weeks. I think everybody knows that, but we're going to see how much of reality is actually in everybody's thinking here. So for us, what's our job? Our job is to sort through the winners and the losers in the new environment to figure out what the new environment is going to look like. The world's going to be here a year from now. I mean, you know us. You know we own the best management teams in our fields. We own the best companies. These are businesses that are very strong financially. There's nothing here that's impossible to deal with. We believe we've actually gone through the period of maximum uncertainty and that we're starting to see big improvements on the medical side, on the virus side, and that is the area that was probably the most uncertain out there. So life has changed here. We're working hard on our end to make sure that what we own is going to be on the right side of the changes that have happened and position the portfolio appropriately. And with that, I'm going to pass it back to Mike for Q&A. Thank you.
David, well done. Great summary. Really appreciate that. Yeah, we've had quite a few questions come in through the sales teams from advisors that are top unit holders in the various funds. And we'll take a few of those on for both you and Dustin. You talked about portfolio turnover. Thank you. You talked about your rise in cash up to 12% and redeployment in the funds. Thank you on that. One common question we get is your positioning, you and Dina, in the Canadian growth and Canadian growth balanced against the peer group, against the benchmark. Clearly, you're doing something different than the rest of the market. You, Canadian growth fund, you've beaten 99% of peers over a 3, 5, and 10-year basis. On Canadian growth balanced, it's 97 over 3, 97 over 5, and 99 over 10. How do you look at positioning? You talked about balance sheet strength and net free cash flow. Can you give us some actual examples of companies and the differential in your positioning versus peers in the Canadian market?
Sure. So the differential versus peers, yeah, it's quite large. We are not benchmark huggers by any stretch of the imagination. The biggest single gap between us and the market, and it's been here for a while, is on the energy front. We ended up going to zero energy globally late last year, early this year. The position size, the overall energy exposure had been in steady decline over the last 4 years. Essentially what happened there was 4 years ago, we'd gone through the shale oil mess, the huge rise in shale, kind of seen that coming through our work with the U.S. shale companies. We started to look on the demand side, and you know, if you know oil, you know that the only thing that ever mattered is supply, because demand always came in year after year after year. Obviously, it's not coming in right now, and you can see what a mess that creates. But we started to realize that electrification was coming. You were really going to have a platform transition. We started, you know, initially thinking about small cars, and by the end of it, I think by last year, we were talking about anything that's horse-powered. At one point, it was probably horse-powered, and you know, you're moving away from gas diesel to electrification. That will play out over the next 10, 15 years. I think it's a lot earlier than people think it is. You know, the big OEMs, the big car companies in Europe, at least, are talking about 50% of sales being electrified in 2 years. So that's coming quite quickly. When you see something like that, when you see a structural problem, you know, you try to reflect it into your models. The problem is that the terminal value of your business, which is about half the value of your company, it's very, very low relative to what the market thinks it is. And as a result, you end up not really being able to own anything. So that's one area that we're quite different. You know, when you talk about the Canadian fund in particular, when I look around at a lot of peer funds, you guys know the story, right? It's five banks and a couple insurers, a couple pipelines, three integrated oil companies. If you look at what we do, it looks nothing like that. We're very much more bottom up. We're very much more individual company oriented. And the overall structure of the fund is the core of it, the bottom, you know, the core 50-ish percent is the Canadian side. That's doing the best we can within the Canadian market. And then what we're doing is we're going outside of Canada. We're going globally. We're not going to the U.S. to find a Citigroup or an ExxonMobil. We are more than capable of finding banks or oil companies in Canada. What we're doing instead is we're going out to find sort of unique compounding businesses. The companies that really over an extended period of time tend to do a lot better than their peers. They tend to do a lot better than the markets. Now, you know, Mike's going to push me to actually name some names here that we haven't actually sold, because I can tell you we had a few companies that on the global side that really were in the eye of the storm, or we think they are. We'll see how they do. So examples on the other side, you know, let's take a medical device company like Baxter. Baxter is a company we've owned for a while. It's just basic blocking and tackling medical device business. When you look at the medical device world, there's not a lot of competition. Most of the areas Baxter's in, there's only two or three companies involved. You have high regulatory barriers. It's very, very difficult to get into them. So you have a company that, you know, has a great management team. They've got really, really solid market positions. The business, we've talked to them already. They think that this whole coronavirus mess will, it'll probably be roughly neutral. I mean, maybe a tiny bit negative, maybe a tiny bit positive, depending on exactly what happens and how it plays out through the U.S. medical system. But it's just a business where, you know, it's steady as she goes. It's a company that's going to grow top line. That's kind of expanding, but organically 4 or 5 should be moving to 6%. You've got a bunch of margin leverage. You have huge free cash flows, and it just kind of grows, just grows and compounds over time. So in a tough period in the downturn, like we've seen now, the stock holds in extremely well. So that's the kind of thing we look for. It's really business by business, and industry by industry. And much of what's out there, we don't have a lot of interest in.
Hey, David, I'll follow up with one that's always on the minds of Canadians, Canadian banks. So maybe your thoughts there, their exposure to energy, their impacts, what you like, what you don't.
So you asked the global guy the Canadian bank question. So I'll give you the Dina DeGear answer on this one, because I don't have a very good one. I started out in the industry actually on the Canadian side, but that's 20-odd years ago. Now, the banks are still the banks, so they're still pretty phenomenal businesses. Our bank exposure, the main holding that we have is Royal Bank. You know, we've been reducing banks, particularly in the 6 months prior to this, just because we started to have some pretty large concerns in terms of interest rates and the shape of the yield curve and how that was going to affect profitability. And we were watching growth rates gradually slow for the Canadian banks. Right now, in terms of the overall effect, you know, it's not going to be positive. The stocks have reflected that, but on the other hand, we're not really seeing anything which looks like the global financial crisis from a banking standpoint. You've had central banks step in a lot faster and a lot harder than we did in 2008-09. I think they learned some lessons from the collapse of Lehman Brothers and why you don't let your financial system collapse. So, you know, broadly speaking, growth rates are a little bit lower than they were. Credit losses are going to go up for a while here, but we think that that's very much priced in. And, you know, it's funny because when you look at the U.S. industry, I mean, I have over 100 banks I could look at. It's just a bloodbath down there. There's all these companies competing with each other. You have huge financial innovation on the edges, picking away at it. In Canada, you have this nice little oligopoly. You have five banks. They've been here for hundreds of years. They're very dominant. Canadians do not switch banking institutions easily. In the States, people are quite happy to switch. So it's just a nice business that tends to do quite well over time.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, why don't we bring Dustin back into things? It's been a while since we've heard from him. Dustin, thanks for your summary at the beginning. One of the notes that I took down was 300 policy measures around the world and all of this stimulus that's coming in. What do you see as long-term impacts? How does this get paid for? How does it translate into inflation and other things, taxation? What are your thoughts in relation to that?
I mean, the big change here, Mike, that's going to happen in the next, you know, 1 to 2 years is going to be, you know, the debt to GDP ratios moving higher. There's, you know, huge numbers here involved. you know, some examples are going to be, I think the U.S. budget deficit is going to be 18% of GDP this year. You know, Australia, the last night or the night before, got downgraded, or at least got put on negative watch by one of the major rating agencies. I think it's not improbable that Canada could also be on negative watch by the time this is all said and done in the next, you know, 2 to 4 quarters, because the size of the package here domestically is a big number. I mean, it's last time I saw it was about $180 billion cap. And it could be even higher, over 200. So, you know, those are going to get, you know, all those deficits are going to balloon, and that's obvious. So the question is, you know, you look at the world, and I bring my FX background into it a bit, right? It's very much a relative game, right? So pretty much everyone is going to see a ballooning deficit. So what does that mean? You know, how does that change the playing field? And everyone's, you know, devaluing in the FX space at the same time, the net, you know, there's little crumbs to play for, but not as much. When everyone's ballooning, you know, at the same time, then obviously, you know, it doesn't necessarily make one particular country look overly quote unquote bad versus something else. So it's going to be an interesting time in terms of reassessing what are AAA, you know, sovereign credits, what are AA sovereign credits, what are single-A sovereign credits, and kind of going, you know, all down the list. I mean, at some point, what I think is going to be very interesting, and anyone who heard me speak, you know, most of the second half of last year and early this year before we stopped doing the due diligence meetings in person, was, you know, spending a lot of time on the Fed's new framework and trying to get inflation higher, right? And I think that, you know, I wouldn't call it a deflation or a disinflation issue before we came into, you know, the current crisis, but inflation was precipitously low, right? For a long period of time, we had a relatively strong economy within the G10 space, in particular in the U.S. I would say slightly less so in Canada. We saw decent wage gains, not massive, not cyclical high all the time, but pretty solid wage gains, and it was not translating to inflation. So in a way, this is going to be very interesting, because you're going to see, you are seeing so much money getting pumped into the system that at some point, you know, again, it goes back to the credit transmission mechanism. When you have real activity, you know, moving forward, and as, you know, as David said so very, very well, you know, as things start to open up, once that rubber hits the road, then you have the potential for some serious inflation well above kind of the normal target of, you know, 2% for many countries and central banks. That'll be very, very interesting. And that is out there, but that is very much, in my opinion, a 21 and maybe even a second half 21 issue now. And it was David so well said, it's really about the timing of what's going to open up and when, because we're not going to be running on, you know, on all cylinders. So the question is going to be, how much inflation can you generate with this much money getting thrown at the system if you're running at half speed? And that's going to be, you know, that's going to be very, very interesting for the fixed income market for obvious reasons, both from the nominal as well as the, you know, the inflation protected side, the real return bond side, so to speak, in Canada. And that remains to be seen. And again, coming anyone who had heard me, second half of last year, the first couple months of this year, you know, I basically said, look, I think the Fed's going to want to keep rates as low as possible, keep the policy rate as low as possible for as long as possible, at least 2 years. You know, that sounds more than obvious now, given what's going on. So in many ways, I don't think they're disappointed to have rates at effectively the zero lower bound. But they will be there. They will be there for a long time. And again, kind of looking a little bit more medium term-ish, another concern I have, and kind of going back to the European side, is, you know, this notion of Japanification around the globe, right? So we know that Japan has had precipitously low inflation rates for a long time. Some of that is demographic driven. Some of that is immigration or lack of immigration driven. There's a number of, you know, savings economy, you know, a number of factors that are driving that. Is this the moment in time where Europe becomes the next Japan? Is this the moment where really Europe struggles to ever get out of negative interest rates from a policy perspective, because they have so much structural discourse, a higher unemployment rate, lower participation rates, a slightly older, business model with cyclical way of doing things. Is this the beginning of Japanification in Europe? And again, I think that's a very, very interesting structural theme and something that, I look at, on behalf of the fixed income team in terms of potentially implementing stuff like that in our portfolios, because the inflation rate, negative rates, it's very, very challenging to climb out of that hole once you've been in there so long, because you already had inflation expectations essentially self-fulfilling, and that was before the crisis. So if you have deflationary tendencies now, and you can't necessarily climb out of that hole, then what I was talking about a few minutes ago in terms of having that wage, wages come higher, the economy move faster, these kind of climb out, start to, open up. You don't actually get that rubber on the road. You don't get that traction. And, I'm concerned about the Japanification of Europe for the medium term. And again, that breeds, I wouldn't say social unrest, but, I would say social concern in terms of, why are we doing this? Why are we tied to a currency that is expensive and we're not able to export our way, out of this problem? What are we doing here? Those sorts of questions, those very big dynamic macro questions kind of come into play. And I think some of the seeds are being sown for that here, as a result of this crisis. So there's a lot of very interesting things kind of, short term as well as kind of the medium plus term, on the horizon with respect to, the out holes, so to speak, the in holes, so to speak, on the backside of 18.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Thank you there. You mentioned one thing that is another question we get commonly and on the minds of advisors here in North America, negative rates or the prospect of negative rates coming to North America.
Right. Well, the Fed's own literature and the Fed's own academic work has strongly, I would say, pushed back on the notion that negative policy rates, I'm talking Fed funds rate, negative policy rates work. They are, for whatever reason, they're very anti-negative rates. They don't want to go there. And they've seen the Japan story, obviously, with not a huge amount of success. Looking at the European story, not a huge amount of success. Swiss is obviously there too. Sweden was there for a long time. So, that I think is, anything is possible, but I think the Fed is really going to resist it. One of the reasons you've had literally an alphabet soup of, programs, from the Fed in the last month is because they're trying to not do negative rates. And I would say the same is probably the case for Canada as well. There is a serious reluctance, and Polaz essentially said this, last week or the week before. They are, never say never, but we really don't want to go there. They want to use the kind of the QE, tools in the toolkit, the TARP programs, the CP purchase programs, the small business programs. They want to use those kind of alphabet soup type, programs before actually going negative. Does that mean that, the curve could go negative? No. I mean, it does not mean that that couldn't happen. It could happen. And frankly, we've seen, U.S. 3-month T-bills already trade negative for a number of weeks now. I would not be surprised if by the time we're kind of through a lot of this negative economic data that we see 2-year notes in the U.S. Trade negative as well. It wouldn't surprise me as this grab for duration continues and North America generally continues to have higher rates than most other places in the world, and people look for a bit of a safe haven play, especially as David was saying, if we get a bit of a head fake on the recent market balance from a risk perspective. So I think that is possible. So always good to clarify, can rates go negative from a curve perspective here? Yeah, I think they could. From a policy perspective, I think it's very unlikely. And you've also seen, a lot of the leaders even though they're smaller countries, Australia and New Zealand, New Zealand, as many people know, was the first central bank to institute an inflation target in the early 90s or late 80s. And, those banks are also effectively at their zero lower bound and doing QEs for the first time. And they are also pushing back very, very heavily on going negative in their policy rate. So that's what I think is most likely to happen here in North America.
Great. Dustin, thank you. David, we're coming into the end of the call. I'm going to hit you with the million-dollar question. What are your teams, you and Dina, what are your assumptions, working assumptions on the economy, sort of timelines, and what does the new normal look like, and how long does it take us to get back there? I know that's the question on everyone's mind. I'll let you kind of sum it up from that perspective, if you like.
So here's the question that we're trying to solve. throw it right back at me. So look, when I first got involved with this particular issue back, a month and a half ago, went through it, and my initial assumption was, yeah, we'd have a quick V-shaped recovery because you went back and looked at history, and we had a few cases where you saw something similar to this, and sure enough, that's what happened. As we got deeper into it, we began to see what countries were doing, and if you think about what's happened in the last month, if we sat down 6 weeks ago, Mike, you and I, and I said we're about to shut the world down, you would have thrown something at me. So when you've seen this happen, it really kind of tosses a lot of your assumptions into the air. So what we've been watching, and I talked about this a little bit, we're watching the countries that are trying to reopen, the countries that have reopened, the countries that never shut, to understand what activity you can actually bring back. So I think our suspicion right now is May, June, I don't think this is anything anyone hasn't figured out. May, June, we're going to start to see reopening. What I think may not be appreciated fully is what reopening actually means, that it's going to be a lot less than we think it's going to be. You're going to have less economic activity. You're going to have, social distancing still in place. We're going to have a discussion around, if you watch a country like South Korea where you have a cell phone app, it tells you if you've been near anybody who's actually had the virus. You have very tight tracking. You have people's temperature being taken in and out of buildings. You have borders locked down where, if you want to go visit South Korea, you get to pay for yourself to sit there for 14 days in a room until you're actually allowed into the country. So we suspect you're going to see that in a lot of places. Will we have any countries that ultimately fail to control this? The one we were really curious about was the United States. Obviously, you're starting to see some improvements in New York. I think our suspicion is, given what they're doing on the policy front, by which I mean the medical policy front, you're going to see some outbreaks taking off in other parts of the country. Beyond that, it seems like most countries are starting to get a bit of a handle on this, so we think curves will go down. So that means you will have a staged reopening. Which activities can you actually do? We don't know that yet. Starting to see some academic research, some papers on that. Should you reopen schools? Should you not? What's the evidence? What have we seen with past flu seasons? On the social distancing side, you're starting to see some pretty interesting big data work. What they're looking at is actually flu. So you have areas where the number of flu cases are 5% of what they should be by now. We have very good data on flu, so you're able to really get your head around transmission. So the answer, really, we're going to reopen. It's not going to be what it used to be. We have some large industries, travel and tourism in particular, that we just cannot come up with a good story for. So we're staying far, far away from them. We have other areas. You have some businesses that we actually think are going to benefit from this. So you just end up with this collection of companies where, they're going to be L-shaped. They're not going to come back. You have companies that are going to take longer to come back. You have companies that are coming back quickly, and you have some where there's never been a negative effect that's material on them because of what they do. That's the portfolio side of it, the economic side of it. Mentioned, and Dustin said the same thing. We're going to see the biggest drop-off in economic activity we've ever seen. We're going to see all kinds of Fed programs, all kinds of government programs. We're going to try to get this back up to what it used to be as close as we can. And then as things start to improve, we're going to start taking out policy measures. Whether or not we're going to do it flawlessly, we won't, but hopefully we can do a reasonably good job of it. Hopefully the policies we put in place are reasonably sensible. And ultimately we're waiting for a vaccine here or some sort of cure. So you've got probably 12 months of this Maybe it's 15. Now, I'll tell you, the market, if we start sniffing out a vaccine is coming in January, the market's not going to sit there until January 1st to do something about it. So you will have the market move well, well ahead of any material improvement in the economy. 2 years from now, we're all going to be wearing I Survived Coronavirus t-shirts. So this isn't going on forever here. We know that as well, which is a bit different than a normal recession. Certainly 08, 09, you started to wonder in the middle of it if it was ever going to get better. I don't think that's the case here at all. So it's quite different that way. We know what the problem is. We're starting to see policies going in that make some sense. We're starting to see improvements on the medical side. You're going to see a lot of innovation. My personal suspicion is things will get better a bit faster than sort of the more dire cases. My other suspicion is, you know, if you hear from people that think the world's going to be all perfect and we're going to go right back to where we were in 2 months, no, it's not going to happen. So,
happen,
you know, somewhere
yeah.
in the middle here. And that's the blue water view.
I appreciate your comments. And clearly, you and Dina have a process, right? One that it's repeatable, that involves, you know, analyzing companies, always questioning your thoughts behind the portfolios. Love that, you know, red, yellow, green. How do we evaluate companies and their prospects under stress? You've always been known for strong balance sheets, net free cash flow, and that's delivered the exceptional results that you've delivered to unit holders. I want to thank you and Dustin for your comments today. I think they were very informative. And we recognize that folks on the line are fielding lots of questions from their investors. And as your partner, we want to be sure that we keep you updated on, you know, relevant topics like these and give you the opportunity to relay those to clients. I want you to urge you to reach out to your McKenzie sales teams, to visit the McKenzie website, to access a platform for manager commentaries like the ones we've delivered today, and a list of upcoming market calls and webinars. And additional resources, we've got a COVID-19 landing page there that's designed to give you access to lots of information. These are indeed extraordinary times, and we thank you for your partnership with McKenzie. We thank you for joining us today, and we wish you and your families a safe and healthy future. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.